間この場所がスタート、イメージしてみよう、何ができるのかな。
Hello and welcome to Reincarnated as Podcasters, the show where we explore the countless and varying worlds of isekai, the anime genre. This is episode 5. It's no understatement to say that isekai is an extremely prevalent genre in the anime landscape. On this show, we hope to find out why that is and what a genre primarily concerned with other worlds has to say about this one. Today, we will be discussing episodes 1 to 3 of The Devil is a Part-Timer, aka Hataraku Mao-sama. But before we get into that, let's introduce our hosts. I'm Vicky, and joining me is Lawrence.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, man. I'm doing well. I'm looking forward to talking about new anime.
Yeah, this is a new journey. Having finished Hamafura, we're getting into a totally new isekai.
What's in the box? What's opening up the present of anime? It's the unboxing experience that rivals that of Apple products.
Yeah, in fact, it's more exciting. It feels like it means something.
And it won't break down on you in 5 years.
Wow, this is biting commentary.
Get wrecked, Steve Jobs. Stay dead, bitch.
Whoa.
All right, it's getting the energy out, you know.
Yeah, get it out.
Firing up the engines.
Yeah, we've got a lot to get through. We need those engines fired. So since we are beginning a new journey and a new anime, shall we return to our personal anime histories? We want to talk a little bit about your anime journey.
Yeah, sounds good. I think the last time we sort of got into this was episode 1 on Hamafura, and I talked about like just watching anime via Toonami, the Toonami diets, so to speak, the Toonami agenda corrupting our youth. So yeah, lots of Gundam, lots of Sailor Moon, Dragon Ball Z, et cetera. But there was kind of a wasteland in between being a teenager and being a somewhat older teenager where I didn't watch any anime at all. Except for some key animation, some key series, you know, Sword Art Online did not escape me, of course. Steins Gate, something like Zankyu no Terror, Terror in Resonance. You know, I kept an eye out on the Shinichiro Watanabe projects and stuff like that. But then pandemic happens, and flip switched in my brain, and now I can only watch anime for some reason. Since then I have watched over 100 in less than a year.
Wow.
I might be exaggerating slightly, perhaps not the healthiest approach, but it's not killing me yet. In fact, it's making me feel pretty good.
Yeah, you must be some kind of anime scholar by now.
I can't make that claim, but it's definitely goals. I hope to one day wear the pointy hat of anime scholarship. It's like a dunce cap, but it says anime on it.
Very the coveted anime scholar hat.
Yeah. One day it will grace my big afro covered head. a couple of highlights from this viewing career, if you could call it that. Big points along the timeline are Evangelion. Stuff like Haibane Renmei and Serial Experiments Lane. Trigger animations, Kill la Kill, Gurren Lagann, lots and lots of Gundam as well. And there are some isekai sprinkled in there too, but none of them are really coming to mind right now. But yeah, that's the cliff notes. Those are the highlights. How about yourself? What are the animes that made up the your viewing career?
Well, I think I mentioned last time that I started off with Dragon Ball Z. And like a few others, like Tenshi Muyo and a bit of Gundam Wing around that time. But like you, I had a wasteland period, right? I didn't watch any anime until I was an adult. I don't know, my early 20s or something. And the first kind of big series I watched in full was Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood.
Hell yeah.
After that, I kind of thought, I just want to watch more and more things like this, please.
Oh, yeah, it's an excellent return to form.
Yeah, so I've watched a few of these long series, like Full Metal Alchemist and Naruto. Well, Naruto and Naruto Shippuden are both highlights for me.
Hell yeah.
Absolutely adore Naruto. And a few other kind of more cerebral ones like Steins Gate and Paranoia Agent and Eden of the East. I really like those thriller anime, so like Monster again is probably in my top five.
Shouts to Monster.
Monster is incredible. And since the pandemic, I would say I actually have been watching more anime as well, like nowhere near as much as you, but I've consumed a few series in this time, including Steins Gate, Jujutsu Kaisen more recently, Ajin, finishing off Attack on Titan slowly.
Slowly but surely.
Slowly but surely, yeah.
Slay that Titan.
And I think I've rewatched all of Dragon Ball Z like 3 or 4 times in my life. Although more recently, Dragon Ball Z Kai, because fuck that filler.
Okay, yeah, I was just about to ask, like, how many times have you seen the episode where Goku and Piccolo get their driver's license?
Well, I have seen the whole of Dragon Ball Z twice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's.
But Dragon Ball Z Kai is what I would watch now.
Hell yeah! Hell yeah! Oh, another question for you: dub voices or sub voices? For DBZ.
Dub voices.
Okay, hell yeah.
I tried the sub voices actually, but it's just Goku's voice is too much for me.
It's wild, right?
I assume what's happened here is like, you know how in Naruto he's played by a woman?
Yeah.
And in Boruto he's played by the same woman, even though he's an adult, he has the same voice he had as a child because they wanted the same voice actor, I'd assume.
Yeah.
So I imagine that's what's happened in Dragon Ball. Like, the same voice actor playing Goku as a child is now playing him as an adult, but I actually haven't looked that up, so I don't know.
No, that is exactly what happened.
Okay.
This lady's been voicing Goku forever. It's like her forever job. Like, she got the bag and held on to it for many, many years, and now she's like this sweet Oba-chan who's like I don't know how old she is, but she's up there in age. She's still hitting the studio. So, yeah, shouts to her.
Yeah, shouts to her, but I still would prefer the dub version.
Yes, no, true, same. It's a big adjustment to make, definitely.
Yeah, I don't think I could make the switch.
Mm.
So yeah, that's us and our personal journeys with anime. I'm sure we'll have more to add to that in the future.
The journey continues.
The journey does continue. With some more isekai, let's get into some definitions that we've been talking about over the course of this series. So isekai is a genre of light novels, manga, anime, and video games that revolve around a normal human person from Earth being displaced, transported to, reborn, or otherwise trapped in a parallel universe, fantasy world, or virtual world, where they must adapt and or assimilate into this new world, along with its new rules, cultures, and philosophies. That's the summary from Wikipedia. Sums it up pretty good. We also have appended to this the Shisetsuka Ninaro definition, which makes a distinction between reincarnation in another world, a work in which the main character died once in the original world and has been reborn as a different person into a different world, and transfer to another world, a work in which the main character moves to a different world in some way, like movement, summoning, possession, etc. So Hataraku Mao-sama definitely fits into the second category there.
Hamafura, we were dealing with a reincarnation into another world, and in Hataraku Mao-sama, it's a portal that our heroes slash villains travel to end up in modern-day Japan.
Hell yeah.
Just a little bit of everything, a sampling of all of the isekais.
Yeah, and we'll do one of every single possible variation at some point. I hope.
I look forward to seeing that, yeah.
Yeah. So given these definitions, as you can probably imagine, isekai as a genre slash plot device isn't necessarily just something you can apply to anime. It can be seen in Western media as well. On this show, we've discussed a few Western media properties, TV shows, movies, books, etc., that might be considered isekai. I think, Lawrence, you've got a fresh one of these to add to the list this week.
I do, yeah. So
hit me with it.
For your consideration, WandaVision.
WandaVision.
The 2020 television show, Disney Plus. You've seen it, right?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. I watched a couple of episodes recently as well, just to be able to talk about it on the podcast. Yeah, I was like, I'll watch two episodes, and I'll have like something to talk about with Vicky on the podcast. I need to watch the rest. I'm not an MCU person, but I was pleasantly surprised to find that it was an all right series. Like, so I watched two more.
Go on. Sorry.
And then it became shit again.
Yeah, I was about to interrupt you and say, come back when you watch the whole thing, so you still think that. in case you didn't get that, I was not a fan of that show. But more to the point, is it an isekai?
Is it an isekai? So just a quick little sum up for anyone listening who has not seen WandaVision. Basically, it is Marvel Universe characters, the Scarlet Witch, plus the Vision, who both people who I don't know or care about.
Exactly.
the Scarlet Witch has used her magic, I think, to create an alternate universe, an alternate setting, based on television sitcom nostalgia, in which she is sort of trapped slash, I wouldn't say, yeah, no, it's very much sort of a trap, actually. It's like
a prison.
Ensnared, like her boy toy, which is a robot, I guess, and a bunch of other people, in order to, I don't know, if I could do that, I'd do that too, I guess. I'm not sure what her motivations are just yet. Yeah, so that's the story thus far.
I don't know how to answer this without fully giving away the story to you. In a way, you could say it's an isekai and that Vision is in another world that he didn't go to on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
How much can I give away here?
Well, you know, I don't mind. You could go ahead and like hit me with the truth. The truth.
Well,
of it.
I guess actually I'm not giving anything away because we know Vision is dead at the start of the show because he was killed in the last Marvel film or whatever.
Okay.
The last Avengers film. So Vision has been reincarnated into Wanda's world, I guess.
Oh, sick.
So, and I guess because it's a sitcom type reality, they have to conform to the rules of sitcoms and adapt to the philosophy of, you know, everything gets wrapped up after the episode. So it goes back to normal every time.
So the Scarlet Witch is capable of like creating an alternate universe within our worlds. It's a different setting with different rules and a different way of doing things, a different way of being. The Vision is moved from one world to the other via dying and being revived, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I didn't realize he was dead. So yeah, I feel like that makes it an isekai, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I can't really argue with that.
Yeah, it seems to conform to all of the rules. I felt pretty sure about it as well as I was watching it. I think some other cool observations about WandaVision as an isekai is that it touches on like some cool like themes and commonalities that you can see between these kind of series. Like we covered Lost briefly in a previous. Yeah. Episodes, and that is another instance of an isekai where the alternate dimension, the alternate world, is sort of a prison or like a purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much about these characters, and like what I do know about them is like the fleeting like stuff I see on my timeline. But I get the sense that Wanda has a lot of stuff to work through.
Yeah.
And that I gathered as much from those four episodes. And this alternate universe is sort of like a projection of her own trauma, insecurities, and like a desire for kind of normalcy that only exists in sitcoms, I suppose.
Yeah, that's exactly what the show is about.
Yeah, I also felt like it had a lot to say about authorship and the relationship between like an audience and the text. And it touched on sort of the responsibility of the transportee, the isekai'd, if you will.
I love that term.
The responsibility that they have towards the people around them that they sort of like drag into their dimension shifts, like the NPCs, so to speak, that populate their new world. Like, how much do you tell them? How much do you not? What is your responsibility towards them? And interesting show. I might watch the rest.
Yeah, definitely finish it off. See what you think after that.
Yeah.
We can revisit this conversation. So I guess to conclude, is it an isekai, WandaVision? Yeah.
That's a yes from me.
Yeah, that's a yes from me too. Well, every time we do this segment, we always answer yes.
Yeah, no, it seems like there's a lot of isekais out there.
Yeah.
It's isekais from top to bottom, you know? It's like
it's pervasive. So before we dive into our episode summary, let's talk a little bit about The Devil is a Part-Timer, a.k.a. Hatarakumao-sama. So like Kamifura, the show we were watching previously, it's based on a light novel series. It's written by Satoshi Wagahara and illustrated by an artist called 029 Oniku, who I couldn't really find anything about apart from in connection to Hatarakumao-sama.
Light novel artists, offers, I mean. I mean, they are artists, but they're offers too. and illustrators for light novels are they seem like a very flighty bunch. They seem they like their anonymity a lot.
Yeah.
Right. I know the offer for Konosuba, a light novel that is made into an anime that I adore, hides behind a mask. There are many other light novel offers that are like don't really want to be known very much. Maybe just a little bit embarrassed, but
maybe.
and you shouldn't be. I like your work, but also if you want to wear a mask, that's fine too.
Yeah,
it's cool.
Could be
actually.
Any number of reasons they're wearing a mask.
yeah. No, exactly.
So it comprises 27 volumes made up of 21 main novels, 2 prequel novels, 1 spin-off novel, and 3 bonus novels.
That's wild.
Whatever that means. Yeah. It's a lot. There is also a manga adaptation and an audio drama adaptation released in 2017 featuring the main cast of the anime series, which sounds quite interesting.
Hell yeah.
The anime series itself was produced by the studio White Fox, who is responsible for Steins Gate, Kame ga Kill, and Season 2 of ReZero. And it was directed by Naoto Hosoda, a director, key animator, and storyboarder on a bunch of stuff that I've never heard of, but there's a lot of it. However, he did work in the animation department for The Garden of Words and 5 Centimeters Per Second, and while I haven't seen the former, I'm a huge fan of the latter.
Hell yeah.
Really, really great movie.
No, I rate them both. I should add they did season one of ReZero as well.
Oh, did they?
Yep.
Cool.
But ReZero season one, excellent. Excellent isekai. Looking forward to covering that one day.
Oh, yeah.
Akame ga Kill, absolute trash tier. Shit tier.
Oh, wow.
But not entirely, because I still think about Akame ga Kill every once in a while.
Yeah.
Like every time I think about it, I'm like, oh shit, that was bad, but why can't I get it out of my head?
Well, I can't say I've seen it, but I'm curious now.
Yeah.
Finally, in charge of the scripts for Hataraku Maosama, we have Masahiro Yokotani, who has been a scriptwriter on Steins Gate and ReZero. I think only like a few episodes, but they were involved with those shows.
Mm-hmm.
So with that out of the way, unless you have anything else you want to add?
Steins Gate is awesome. Fucking S tier. I love, love Steins Gate. White Fox, I've seen Steins Gate, Akame ga Kill, ReZero, and like a couple of other animes of theirs. I don't remember. They have sort of a reputation as being a studio that doesn't take on many projects, but the ones that they do take on, they like to achieve a certain level of quality, and then they commit to it and they do a great job of it.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to what they do with this one.
Yeah, me too. So in this segment, we are going to summarize the first three episodes of Hataraku Maosama, and we're going to start with episode one. The Dark Lord arrives in Sazazuka. We begin with a voiceover, a narrator explaining the geography of the fictional continent of Enteisla on the ocean of Ignora, which is surrounded by four islands, I believe, to the northeast, south, and west.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the cruel Dark Lord Satan of the Underworld strikes fear into the hearts of all of its inhabitants.
So I'm looking at this map, and the first thing that comes to mind is, yes, four chicken tenders and a meatball. That's what this map looks like. Just some,
that's what they drew.
Some delicious tendies. Some real lazy RPG map making and world building, which might be on purpose. Perfectly round center island is probably home to another perfectly round isekai kingdom, like in Amafura, which we will see recurring for some reason. But luckily, we exit this plane of existence pretty soon. So
we do, yeah. we don't have to spend too much time here.
Yeah.
Fortunately. So the narrator describes how Satan, aka the titular Maosama, declared war on the human race and sent his four demon generals to launch attacks on the neighboring islands. We are then treated to a montage of gross goblins, skeletons throwing Rasengans, and evil birds, all doing battles with guys in full medieval lock.
Wait, hold up. Who said the birds were evil?
They were totally evil. They were attacking the LARP guys.
No, they were, if I recall correctly, they were just minding their own business, like flying, soaring through the air, being majestic, when all of a sudden they get like a bunch of arrows like shot at them by these shitty Robin Hood fuckers. And then they get ate by wolves, which is, you know,
yeah,
the circle of life. And
it was the circle of life moment.
Exactly what they deserve for fucking up some birds that did absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's true. They are just flying and then you see them full of arrows. I don't think I actually saw them hurt anyone.
No, sweet birds. R.I.P. Is Mao the biblical Satan, or is he a different Satan?
I don't know.
This happens to be called Satan.
Yeah, it's hard to say. They call him the Lord of the Underworld, but it could just be that he is the Lord of a place called the Underworld that exists in this universe. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. He does have a general called Lucifer, and I thought those were the same dude.
And Alziel. But Alziel is like one of Satan's people, right? I don't know. My biblical knowledge is terrible.
One of Satan's boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, that's JRPGs for you, and like fantasy properties in general, just playing fast and loose with IRL mythology and fiction such as the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Ooh, just stroked my beard while saying that. Stroked my beard and lifted my fedora.
You know, if I had a beard, I'd be stroking it too right now.
Wonderful.
However, Satan's generals were rebuffed by a classic hero type who is able to rally the humans and advance on Satan's palace. We see knights doing battle with demons while they talk in some made-up language, which confused me at first because I thought I had gotten some weird language dub of the show, but it was just the made-up language that they were talking in.
Gotta hate it when I get rebuffed by the classic hero. classic hero, man. This Jidenna's classic hero.
Pretty much. Some person wearing armor. That's it. Satan and his generals seem done for. He concedes Enteisla to the human forces, but vows to return before vanishing into a big purple hole in the sky. And I believe this is the they call it a gate. It's a portal.
Gato. Yeah, this was hype. Mm-hmm. They definitely front loaded all of the hype shits in this episode before they go into like mundanity and like the hypeness of that kind of mundanity. Spell effects were like just on lock, like little fight scenes and shit. It's like they kind of went all out for a show that sort of at this point seems to be sort of a slice of lifey or like operating on those tropes for as far as we know.
They put a lot of effort into making this Enteisla world very cool looking.
Yeah.
Via fancy animations and stuff, but
the fights and the goblins, look goblin-y.
Yeah.
it's just a map actually that they skimmed out on. The rest is pretty dope actually.
Satan and his general Alciel find themselves in an alley in a very different world, modern-day Tokyo. And this moment really confused me because I watched the episode twice, but I never saw Alciel go through the gate. Did you?
Oh. Yes. I think so.
I just missed that both times.
I don't think they make like a huge deal out of it. I don't think you're wrong to be a little bit confused by that. Apparently, the rest of Satan's generals got knocked out of the running as well. We don't really get to see that either. But Alciel makes a big deal out of being alive and rescuing Mao Satan. Mm-hmm. And another thing is that their faces are mostly obscured throughout this prologue.
Segments,
their true faces, their true looks are not entirely visible in this bit. Yeah, and it's not until they get through the gate and enter into the lamplight of modern day Tokyo that we see these cute anime boys.
Yeah.
So cute.
Yeah. Their appearances change.
Yeah.
It's a cute young adults in demon cosplay. Their claws are now simple, supple fingers, which they seem very confused about. they're cute young lads. They come out of the alley into the city, and a couple of police officers see them and try to figure out what the hell these two widows are doing here, dressed like that. They conclude that the lads must be cosplaying foreigners, and their response is to take them down to the station, which is, it seems like a classic cop response to finding foreigners.
Yeah, this is just fucking typical. Just out here being foreign on a Friday night in Japan, and the cops are like, we're not having that. Because what, they're cosplaying too hard?
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like... It's probably not the parallel that they were going for, but I'm going to keep coming back to how Hataraku Mao-sama represents the immigrant experience. I'm only half serious when I'm saying this, so keep that in mind every time I say it. Because these are not the model immigrants that the Daily Mirror I'm trying to demonize. They just come back from being persecuted in their home world and being persecuted by the demons, and then they are confronted with persecution IRL in our world, and like Alciel being a fucking G, his first reaction is fuck 12. Let me hit these motherfuckers with lightning bolts. But no spell is produced.
Yeah.
was already on his way to best boy status.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of this guy. So down at the police station, where the cops have taken Mao and Alciel, they've been put into separate rooms. The cops feed, or try to feed Mao, a tasty-looking anime katsu don. And he and Alciel both keep calling it a cat's doom, which I thought was very funny.
Yes. And I
feel like find myself walking around my house muttering it, cat's doom.
But they say it in such a great way as well.
Yeah.
Like
cat's doom.
It's the katsu don, the way it's like animated and drawn is fucking propaganda, first of all. It looks delicious.
And it comes with a bowl of soup and everything.
Hell yeah, it's like all of the trimmings. And the cop is like, usually we don't do this, but I'm one of the good ones, so I bought it with my own money. Like, fuck off.
Right.
I don't believe that shit. Alciel looking at the katsu don is like, cuts doom. Its very name rings with power.
I love that moment.
Yeah, I like that.
So like you, Mao is skeptical of the katsu don at first, but he uses his underworld magic to analyze the recipe for some reason. He talks about it in great detail.
Yeah.
He lists every single thing that was done to every ingredient in order to make the dish before interrogating the cop with hypnosis. He then comes into the room that Alciel is in and finds him digging the fuck into his katsu don and enjoying it, and explains that he has learned that they are in Tokyo, Japan, Earth, the universe, and magic does not exist here. Alciel is amazed by the power of the katsu don. Cat's doom.
He's like, he's eating it very angrily as well.
Yeah. After leaving the police station, I guess they just got let go. The two discuss their situation and their waning magical powers. It seems their magic is like a very limited here.
Mm-hmm.
They conclude that they must preserve their magic while they figure out a way to return home. Until then, they must conform to the horrifying rules of this reality.
Yeah, so at this point, I'm like trying to break down the rules of this anime and the rules of the world that we're being presented with. It seems like my conclusion is they sort of draw their power from the environment around them, and Isla being like a magical environment, they sort of like draw their power from like the ether,
yeah.
I guess. And since there is no magic in this world, except Holy Potter. they're unable to, and their magic sort of like slowly dissipates from their bodies, I suppose, and like unable to recharge.
Yeah, I think to confirm that theory, at some point in the show, they talk about how Amelia can't use her magic because she can't draw on the power from the heavens, so I guess there's some kind of like a special place they get it from in the other world.
Mao also makes the observation here that humans perhaps serve as the basis for all of the magical creatures, which sounded like some human essentialist fantasy race erasure to me.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, just sort of like trying to figure out why they look like cute boys and not their demigods, fucking thunder chucking badass selves.
I mean, they look much better now, IMO, but they probably don't feel that way. Mao and Alciel have to obtain ID cards. They open a bank account. They enter an estate agent and they freak out about how good Mao-sama's Japanese has gotten. And the reason I'm noting this is because I thought that scene was really, really weird. How Mao says something in Japanese like, I want to rent a room. And the two of them just freak out. And they're like screaming at each other about how great they are and how fantastic this is. For like way too long.
Yeah, what was the joke they were going for here?
I don't know.
Japanese is hard to learn.
Yeah.
And like Alciel is a kind of an adoring yes man, so he's just
He
a
is, yeah,
sort
that's
of
true.
a Mao's hype man at this point here. And like whenever they switch to the fictional language, they really start chewing up the scenery, and they really start like laying it on, like, for some reason. But
Yeah,
it's pretty
I
funny,
noticed
actually.
that. They rent a bleh, bleh. They rent a one-room apartment and meet their landlord, whose humanity seems to be in doubt. They seem disgusted by her. Welcome to your new life as a human, Malsama.
Miki T.
Yeah, Mickey Theme, the landlady.
So this anime so far is like establishing all of the enemies, the number one and the cops, and number two the landlords. But I absolutely love Miki T's design here.
Me too,
Yeah.
yeah.
She says her name is written with the kanji for beautiful and shining.
Yes.
Utsukushi kagayaku. She looks like a blob fish, like a fat jokes,
Yeah,
etc., etc.
exactly. She's a fat joke.
Yeah, that's what they're going for. But she looks great.
She does look great.
She looks like the evil witch from Howl's Moving Castle, who also looks fantastic.
I can't think of what that looks like, but I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. Oh, another observation here. We've established the baddies, so to speak. We've also got a goal that Alciel and Mao are
Yes.
pursuing. What they were looking for, and how I sort of distilled it, is they're looking for magic, basically, within this mundane world. They need a source of power, a source of magic. And again, bringing it back to the immigrant experiences made me think of a pursuit of an impossible goal, this impossible goal of like a incorporation,
Naturalization.
yeah, naturalization, and like pursuing this American dream is one word for it. But like every country has their own model of that, their own like and in Britain we have the that's the admirable figure of the football loving beer.
I know what you're getting at.
Those British people you want to adore and emulate, like Prince
Yeah,
Philip.
but yeah, it's funny. Like now you're saying that, I can't think of what like a British person is.
Wait,
You know what I mean? Or like, what is the British dream?
what's the
I
British
don't
dream?
know.
Well, being able to say that you're British in public for one, I'd love to
Yeah.
be able to do that again, please. Having a fucking pie at the fucking pub, simple
Pie and
as.
chips with a pint. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
true.
with my mates, me mates.
With my mates. Well, there's footy on the telly.
Wearing me trousers.
Wearing
Or maybe not, actually.
whatever the hell you want, you're British.
Hell yeah. The British dream. Sorry, that's a heck of a tangent.
It's worth noting as well that their logic is that since magic exists in fiction in this world, like Harry Potter, for example, there must be some basis for it in reality. They're saying it must come from somewhere, there must be real magic somewhere, so we must be able to find that and get our magic back.
Has to be based on real magic, not humans' gross imagination
Disgusting.
that brought us anime.
So next, they're in the apartment that they've just rented, tiny little apartment, just one room. Mao-sama suddenly collapses and is rushed to hospital in an ambulance, only to learn that human beings need to consume food for sustenance or something. So I guess he just hasn't eaten. He didn't eat his katsudon. Alciel ate his, so he's fine.
Yeah, I hate it when I gotta sustain my body with
I
food.
know, such an inconvenience.
It's fun when you're doing it, but leading up to it sucks.
Or I guess being an adult and actually having to prepare the food is what sucks. I like it to just appear in front of me. Mao is enraged. This is my interpretation. I didn't fully understand. Mao is enraged by the concept of food costing almost as much as rent. It seemed incredulous to me that the food could cost almost half as much as rent.
Maybe there was something up with your subs,
because
he was referring to the IV that he got at the hospital,
in
my
see.
Subs.
Yeah. Okay.
It's like, and because he was an insured, he had to like pay for the IV drip,
he's like, that makes way more sense.
Oh, what the fuck? So a day of sustenance is equal to 1 month's rent, which is. Yeah, it's a great little way of introducing the inequity of the world that we live in via being an uninsured, undocumented immigrant in a country that you've just come to, where you renting a shit apartment from a slumlord, because it doesn't seem safe. A beautiful slumlord. Doesn't seem safe. It's like six tatami mats, like big.
Yeah.
Like...
yeah, it's really tiny, and it's pretty much just a little kitchen with a table. They sleep on the floor. So yeah, it turns out that Mao and Alcia will need jobs in order to make this whole eating and living thing work. And here we get a flash forward. It's unclear how much time has passed. I don't know if you got a sense of that, maybe a few weeks or something. Alciel, now with the human name Ashia, has been fully domesticated. He's a domestic goddess of some kind. And I really like this part of his character, how he kind of takes on the emotional labor of managing the household while Mal kind of does whatever.
Yeah, he's gotten into mom mode, definitely.
We see him washing dishes while Mao reads what looks like a manga. Ashia berates Mao for his poor money skills and his terrible lifestyle choices.
So they're out of money, basically. Mao just bought a fridge and a washing machine and a bike. And he's like, it's all right. I'll survive on eating burgers from my job. And he's like, is this a Super Size Me? Which is, awesome reference, 21st scene, gotta love it. But another funny thing here is I had the opportunity to watch this with two different fan dubs.
Mm-hmm.
And in the one fan dub, Ashia is sort of like lecturing Mao on like frugality and like saving money, etc. But in the other sub, he is really weirdly existential. He's like, we're going to be here at least 10 years. 10 years is a really long time. You got to like feed yourself right and maintain a healthy diet for 10 years. And it's going to be gone in the blink of an eye.
Wow.
Yeah, it's... that's a weird difference how they decided to translate that.
But... that's wild. I'd be curious to listen back and see how much of that stuff is he's actually saying.
Mm-hmm.
So Mao escapes this sort of argument. Not really an argument. The telling off.
It's a bollocking.
The bollocking. And he goes to work, but only after Ashia makes sure that he takes his umbrella with him. So he really is taking on the mum role, isn't he?
So sweet.
Take your umbrella. However, Mao actually gets rid of his umbrella. He gives it to a girl at a crossing who is, it's raining, so she's soaking wet and she's out of breath. So he gives her his umbrella before heading to his job at McGronald, which is a burger place.
McGronald.
I guess bearing no resemblance to living brands or anything like that.
Legally distinct from.
Yeah, whatever the other one is. So there's a promotion on at Mao's workplace for black pepper fries, and Mao is determined to work hard and take the top place. I mentioned this to you, how when I first watched this episode, I had Sam make us black pepper fries the same night. They sounded delicious, and they are.
Hell yeah. No, just just crack some fresh black pepper on there. And
loads of it.
Hell yeah. I love me some pepper.
So as he's working, Mao ruminates on how each cheeseburger he sells brings him one step closer to returning as the great Dark Lord. We meet Mao's colleague, Chi-Chan, who is absolutely enamored of Mao's customer service abilities. He's truly attentive to the needs of customers, which for some reason makes him extremely cool to her.
You're so responsible. What an
You
adult.
thought of everything now. It's because he like heats up some baby food or something for a baby, and she's like, "Oh my god, you even thought of the baby." It's weird. It's a weird shift. Or I guess because I didn't get a good sense of how much time has passed. Mao seems to have assimilated into being a human really quickly. He just seems like a regular nice kid.
Yeah.
At his job. Doesn't seem very Satan-y.
No, exactly. This is, I think, one question we're going to run up against in watching this series is, like, from the isekai point of view, from the point of view of, like, someone who engages with these kind of novels, series, games, etc., for escapism. Just what exactly is it that they're escaping to? And, at this point, I'm, like, trying to come up with some ideas. Right now, it's Mao is blending in. He's being good at his job, and he's being admired for it, rather than like being sort of a knee deep in the drama of a world that needs rescuing or destroying, perhaps. So that's a kind of a fantasy, and just what kind of fantasy that is, I sort of figured out a little bit later. We'll get to that.
Nice. I'm looking forward to it.
just as an aside here. Chiho sells a happiness meal with an iced coffee to the a lady with the baby, and she charges 730 yen for that. For some reason, I just had to run that number into Google. Like I just feeling just procrastinating, I guess. And it turns out that 730 yen is 6.66 US dollars.
Whoa!
Yeah, how fucking sick is that?
This one hell of an Easter egg.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's an Easter egg because, like, the fucking exchange rates, like, are wild. I don't even know how the fuck those things work. I doubt it was like $6.66 in 2013 when this anime
that's
was
true.
Released.
That's true. Oh, that's a weird coincidence then.
Yeah, it's just a funny coincidence. Yeah, yeah. just an awesome coincidence.
Yeah.
Shout outs to Satan, the devil.
Yeah, we love Satan.
Mao, Lucifer.
while this is all going on, Ashia is busy researching magic at a library, convinced that magic probably really exists somewhere. Harry Potter must be rooted in some kind of reality. He talks to himself about how upset he is that Mao has become an underling, I guess via working at McGronald's, and an earthquake interrupts his weird little monologue. Back at McGronald's, Mao and Chi-Chan are working hard to sell black pepper fries until, to his horror, Mao discovers that the fryer is busted from frying too much. Mao debates using the last of his magic to try and save their chances of winning this promotion, but he decides against it, and he's kind of interrupted by his boss anyway.
Yeah, and this has happened to me. When I was working in a kitchen, I thought I was going to just acutely drop dead. He like tipped the fries over into the fry catcher, and they're all still fucking white and cold. I'm like, fuck, I am dead. I deserve to die. I must die on the spot here to make up for this this enormous fucking error.
Hey, you don't need to die. You can at least start with self-flagellation.
I was hungry that day. I skipped breakfast, and I was looking forward to sneaking some fries after I made someone some fries. Another thing that I observed here, Mao's boss insists on being called by her first name rather than Tencho.
Yeah.
This is call me Akagi-san, or she's very angrily insisted, actually.
Yeah, she had a weird vibe.
Yeah.
When we met her earlier in the episode. Yeah,
yeah.
I don't quite get her deal yet.
Yeah, and a customer here asks, orders Chi-Chan to smile. She's like, "Can I take your order?" And the guy's like, "Smile, Okuda-sai." And she does the most strange smile.
Yeah, she was not happy about that. Yeah, I felt very bad for her, actually.
Yeah.
All in a day's work, huh?
Yeah, and Lastly, Mao here is basically living the life of the NPC, whereas previously in his previous life he was, you know, the big bad, the villain that sort of sets the story into motion, pretty much the protagonist of his own story, of course.
That's true. And that's why when Ashio is kind of talking to himself, he gets, I think he has some kind of like, he's thinking about some memories of Mao getting excited over like earning an extra 10 yen or something like that, or an extra 100 yen. And he gets upset and says, I can't believe you've become an underling.
Yeah, well, that makes him an underling to an underling, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Still loves him, though.
Yeah, we stan. Later on, Mao is called to his boss's office and is convinced he's about to be found out or fired. Turns out, she just wants to promote him to employee rank A. Excited, on his way home, Mao runs into the girl from the crossing earlier that morning, who reveals that she witnessed him attempting to use magic, and is in fact Emilia the hero.
This is a moment pregnant with a meaning.
yeah.
At least that's how it felt to me.
Yeah, this is an important moment.
This is a significant. I feel like Yusha Emilia's interruption or intervention in the life of somewhat fully assimilated Mao is a sort of an example of the way in which your past life as an immigrant can suddenly be. Can memories of a past life sort of become inflamed in your mind once again, and these memories that it can be a traumatic, sort of something that you escape from catches up to you in this new life that you've created. And at this point, I started wondering, like, just what exactly was he running from? What was he trying to achieve? And I thought about the prologue. Again, I don't think that they place a tremendous emphasis on Mao being like evil per se.
Yeah.
Might be a little bit of a stretch from me, but I felt like he was trying to create something like conditions of livability for the ghoulies and the goblins, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what they said he wanted.
That's what it. Yeah, that's sort of the sense that I got, and I was like, okay, Mao, Satan, like a big bad. Shit, Satan, Mao has got gifted child syndrome.
Okay, elaborate. Run with this. I like it.
Yeah, so Mao is a gifted child. He's like been foisted with these enormous, these soaring expectations in his previous life. He has to lead an army, liberate a peoples. He's gifted. He's never been challenged, and everything that he picks up, he does with ease. And that's sort of like the characteristics of you know, and the gifted child syndrome is sort of like a pop psychology kind of thing. You know, you see it come up on Twitter all the time, and I just have to laugh every time. But basically, this thing that a gifted child encounters later in life is that because they were so good at picking things up the first time around, when they were younger and they were like unchallenged, they have you know, no work ethic, and when they're confronted with an actual talent challenge that they're unable to overcome, they sort of crumble under pressure and suffer from burnout, depression, isolation. You can check all of these things out, right?
Yeah.
So right now, I'm sort of picturing Mao as this gifted child, sort of at the peak of his campaign for a liberation of the ghoulies. And all of a sudden, a hero sort of topples him from his throne, and he's like, "Fuck! I fucked up. This has never happened to me." He loses a horn, it gets cut off of his head, and he's like, "Fuck this! I'm getting out."
Yeah, he just evacuates.
Yeah, he exits stage left, ends up in a modern day Tokyo where he gets a free reset, loses all of his powers except the ones that just barely allow him to like integrate into society, and then all of a sudden he's got a shit job. He gets to be an underachiever, and like the people around him seem to like love him for some reason because he's able to flip burgers and cook fries, which I've done that. It's fucking tough. Definitely not playing that down. But this has got to be a dream come true for someone who previously had like the world foisted on him. Right.
Yeah. I like this theory.
Yeah.
And that gives Amelia like an even more special meaning, right? Because she's always like telling him off and saying how pathetic he is now. She's like the voice in the back of your head, even though you're happy, telling you, you could be doing more. You should be doing more.
Precisely. That's the voice that I'm in the so-called gifted child, and I'm like doing big air quotes here. Just hears constantly is like, aren't you better than this? Shouldn't you be doing more than this, etc., etc. And then I thought about Japan and Japanese culture, and like I don't want to generalize in any sense, but I've always understood that there is a very strong emphasis placed on achievement, especially in academics, etc., which, you know, absolutely not exclusive to Japan. You can find that anywhere. But would this not be the kind of character that some high schooler would relate to? Wouldn't Mao be like, you know, I'm Mao. I wish I could run away from fucking test taking and just flip burgers, but still have everybody love me. So that's where I'm at the end of episode one of Hataraku Mao-sama. Top tier stuff, top tier anime.
I really enjoyed the first episode. I thought it was strong. It had just enough humor. It was very funny, and the characters are fantastic, especially LCL/Ashia.
And they just get better is what I wanted
and
to
they,
say.
Yeah, they do just get better. And there's an element of like class consciousness to the show as well, the way these two young men struggle through life with little money.
I love to see the struggle for real.
That's the first episode. Episode 2, the hero stays at the Dark Lord's stronghold for work reasons. Flashback time. We see the moment at which Mao-sama and LCL entered the portal back in their world, this time from the perspective of Amelia the hero. It turns out that she followed them through it. And back in our world, Amelia is confronting Mao and threatening him with what turns out to be a cheap and very shitty knife, which he mocks. And it turns out that she can't really use her magic either. They mention her heaven sword or something like that, but she won't tell him what happened to it, where it is.
Yeah.
I kind of had an interpretation that maybe it got turned into the cheap shitty knife, but since like all their appearances changed and stuff, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's the Seiken, the holy sword. They sort of have a back and forth of petty barbs here that made me flash back to Keith and Giordo, except it wasn't dumb. Amelia calls him a part-time Dark Lord, and Mao calls her the 100 yen hero.
Perfect.
I really like this this introduction here because it sort of emphasizes just how much they have both changed. Mao is very surprised when Amelia threatens him, and she's like, sleep with one eye open, which Mao interprets sort of literally. And at the same time, he's like, that's not the kind of thing that a hero should say, is it? They've changed. This is their new ground that they're standing on. This new relationship.
Yeah, new dynamic between them.
Yeah,
will be developed.
Also, this tension is immediately hot, of course.
Yeah, I mean, we can see
we,
where this is
we, we
going,
know where this
but.
is going, except it's not going to happen. I will be bitterly disappointed if they don't hook up.
Yeah, don't get your hopes up. It'll be like the tension will be built up over the series, but nothing will ever come of it.
We're ready for it.
Their antics, their arguing and whatnot, lands them back at the police station. The police seem like very willing to arrest pretty much anyone they can. And here, a cop speculates that they may be having a lover's quarrel. Emilia is humiliated and furious at the suggestion and decides to retreat, though not without telling Mao to watch his back. And she threw out his umbrella in some kind of fit of fury, so he won't be getting that back.
Petty, petty queen. She not only threw away the umbrella, but she destroyed it first, and then threw it away.
Yeah, she hates his guts. The next day, we see Amelia at work at a call center handling customer complaints. Her colleague invites her for lunch, but she rejects her mercilessly. Yeah, this colleague has a hard go of it.
I strongly relates to Amelia in this position. Actually, just in the job that she's in, she's a fellow call center drone, basically. And this isn't immediately apparent, but it feels like her sort of repeated refusals of her coworkers. The coworker's gonna keep trying, and she's gonna keep refusing, which, yeah, hard save. But it speaks to Emilia's self-perceived status or self-perception at this moment. She sort of she feels sort of elevated above all of this work, and like and this a workplace relationship thing is not worth her time. Which yeah, we've been there. We've all been there.
I get, I can relate, I think. Sometimes you just want to eat alone in the toilet. After work, Amelia picks up groceries and cheap toilet paper before settling in for some quality reality TV, although I couldn't quite understand what was going on in the show she was watching. Some kind of, I don't know, the guy goes to someone's house and talks about the food they're eating or something.
Obnoxious dinner invader. The show is called Kaboom, Dinner at the Neighbors or something. And he like makes a very funny pun about sticky and
Sticky and
sticky.
cakey. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sticky and stucky. That's cute.
And it's like she sort of has a little breakdown at the TV here. I wanted to point out a scene that spoke to me tremendously. There is a brief moment after Amelia has finished work and she's walking up the high street, and like just after work, feeling dejected, and like quietly like snapping up deal. She like sees some cheap toilet roll and she's like just austerely just like buy some cheap toilet roll. Walks past a store selling some deep fried snacks, and I'm like, oh shit, this walk, this walk from work back home after a long day of fucking doing shit. This is me like every day. Oh, I don't feel like cooking. I'm just gonna buy a bunch of fucking corn croquettes and eat those. And oh yeah, I'm gonna need some cheap toilet paper. Let me grab that real shit. And if you're listening to a anime podcast, I don't need to tell you this, but anime is not for kids. I'm just gonna have to re reiterate that, because kids don't fucking know how this feels. Kids don't fucking know the feeling of sucking at your job all day long, walking back home, the sun setting, don't feel like cooking, don't feel like doing anything, but you got to like adult somehow.
There really is a sense of quiet despair in that scene where she's just quietly walking down the street, isn't there?
She's alone and she hates it.
Man. Brutal.
While she's watching the show as well, she sort of shouts to herself, "I'm no better than him." And for a second, I thought she was talking about the TV show host.
I've never heard of this guy invading people's dinners.
But she's talking about Mao, and at this point, I'm like, I think Mao is sort of winning here, you know?
She's obsessed with him.
No, Mao is doing well. He's come up against unforeseen circumstances. He's rolling with the punches, but he's also got goals, you know?
Yeah,
As
and he's got a friend with him as well.
he's got a very supportive, very patient friend, and he's got somewhere that he wants to be, and Amelia has a neither of those things. And I'm sure we'll get to that shortly, but this is sort of highlighted in sort of their meal choices as well. I might have gotten a little bit granular here. But Amelia is sort of like stuffing herself with these deep fried corn croquettes and potato croquettes and stuff. Basically, that's her sustenance. The one thing that's keeping her going is the prospect of having her revenge on Mao, which is no way to live. That's no way to move forward. Whereas Mao and Alciel, they're having struggle dinners. They're eating konnyaku and cucumbers, which maybe not the most nourishing of foods, but it's better than a big bag of fried shit.
Yeah, I guess.
And I love fried foods. And I'm watching this like, fuck, I'm Amelia. That's me. I've got no goals, big bag of fried food. Shit, I'm Amelia. It's alone and sad. Nothing but my anime podcast to comfort
this just got pretty bleak.
Yeah, well, I related.
Yeah, I think Amelia could do with someone to lean on, I think. Not having, I mean, she's alone in the world that she doesn't know, and not having some supportive influence has probably driven her a little bit cray.
No doubt.
Back at Mao and Alciel's place, as you mentioned, they eat some konjac jelly and cucumbers, but they somehow make it look delicious, and it sounds really crunchy when they eat it.
Yeah,
And they got a bit of rice with them as well.
and you're eating it in company. That's a massive improvement.
These boys can't catch a break though, as Amelia shows up demanding entry to their shitty apartment. Alciel freaks out and double locks the door. He really doesn't want her to come in.
It's like Amelia giving off some strong, like disgruntled ex vibes
Yeah,
right
throughout the whole
here.
thing so far. Mao informs Alciel that Amelia is also powerless. She can't do any magic or whatever, and tells him to let her in. And when she comes in, she insults their apartment and their food choices. Mao reminds her that they are, in fact, poor people. And Amelia goes on to inform them via flashback that the High Priest from Enteoslo was meant to join her in entering the portal, but was shut out at the last moment, so she's here alone. And Mao reveals his grand plan to conquer Japan by working his way up to full-time employee at McGronald's and gaining money and influence somehow. Ashio applauds, but Amelia is less than enthusiastic. His grand plan could do with some work, IMO.
And it's unrealistic and short-sighted, but he has a plan. He's got a goal in mind. That's more than Amelia has right now. And I think Alciel knows it's unrealistic, but he's still like just sitting there like clapping, being supportive as fuck because he's the best.
He is the best.
I also really loved in this moment where like Amelia is sort of dunking on their dinner, and Mao is like, "Hey, Alciel's a great cook," and he turns to Mao and he looks so pleased. It's adorable.
We always stand, Alciel.
Stan a king, Stan a queen, perhaps a mom, a mom queen.
Yeah, we stan a mom.
Yeah.
So I guess after Mal reveals his very good plan, dejected, Emilia leaves the apartment and goes home. At her job the next day, Emilia's colleague tries to make dinner plans with her, but is once again cruelly rejected.
Get freaked.
Yeah, over and over, she never learns. Emilia has other plans, actually, to stalk Mao and Alciel. She follows them around for a few days, only to find that their disappointing lives are filled with nothing but queuing for cheap eggs, visiting public baths, and experimenting with putting honey on cucumbers. Is that what they do?
Yeah.
Life hacks. He like puts honey on a cucumber and says, "See, it tastes like honeydew melon." And Alciel's like, "Why don't you just buy a honeydew melon?"
Just out here struggling. Yeah, Emilia, I think, is doing a transference here. All of my psychology knowledge is from fucking popular psychology magazines and just the barest amount of reading I did at uni. But she has a certain idea of Mao that she is just unwilling to change, despite the evidence to the contrary. And it's for her own sake. This is the world that she built up, and she's not letting it crumble.
Yeah. Every time she sees them leave their apartment, she's convinced they're about to go and do some evil thing. But, yeah, they're just like queuing at the supermarket or like having a wash or whatever.
Also, Mao says that he got the honey on cucumber idea from Chio. But I feel like their circumstances are different. Like, Chio is definitely like dipping cucumbers in honey for fun because she's a kid and she gets to do whatever.
Right, yeah. She lives with her mom.
Yeah, exactly. But Mao and Ashia are fucking struggling, and this is just another struggle, a struggle dessert for them.
Yeah, struggle dessert. Oh, man. I'm sure it's delicious, though. It kind of sounded delicious to me.
I'd try it just to say that I tried it, but
I don't want to waste a cucumber.
That's a good point, yeah.
The next evening, Mao is back at work at McDonald's, and Emilia is all in his face. She demands that he meet her after work alone.
There's some more angry ex energy here.
Yeah, exactly. Even Chi notices it. She's like, "Who's that girl? She's pretty. Why are you talking to her? Do you know her?" Obviously very jealous already. Before leaving work, Chi mentions some troublesome earthquakes from the day before that are apparently localized entirely in her bedroom. She said they made her CDs fall over, but no one else noticed them, which will be important. Later, Mao meets Emilia. She suggests that his pathetic life in this world is free of evil deeds, and that it might be better for him to stay here rather than return to being the Dark Lord. Mao calls her a pervert and falls off of his bike. Or at least he kind of calls her a pervert.
So she also suggests that perhaps she would call off the revenge plan if Mao decides to stay, right?
Yeah, she does.
Do you think she's letting him off the hook here, or what do you think? Where is she approaching this ship from?
It kind of seems like she pities him. Like, she saw how powerful he was in the other world, and here he, like, to her, in her eyes, he's just so pathetic, like working at this burger place and struggling eating konjac jelly for dinner. But also, like, at the burger place, he's great with customers and whatnot. I think she finds it pathetic. And she would take no pleasure in like destroying him how he is now. Maybe it's better for her. Like, how honorable could she be destroying him when he's like this? How much of a hero could she be?
No, for real. Yeah, for me, I saw it from just a slightly different angle. I feel like this is Emilia in a very low place herself, and like what she's really asking Mao is, are we staying here forever? Is there a way back, or are we stuck here for good? And if so, how do you do it? How do you cope? because yeah, she's not getting along as well as Mao is right now.
Yeah.
She also calls Mig Ronalds Mig Rs,
Does
and
she?
yeah, and Mao makes fun of her for that. That's funny.
Didn't notice that. All of a sudden, the two find themselves being shot at by an unknown assailant. They make a run for it, and once they're safe, Mao speculates that their attacker was using magical energy to shoot at them. Clearly shook and having lost her wallet in the chaos, Amelia humbles herself to ask if she can stay the night with Mao and Ashia. Ashia gives Mao hell for staying out all night with that harpy and bringing her back to their home. Amelia finds a spot on the floor and hunkers down.
I really like this bit. It's the
Yeah.
calling a truce with a stalker ex, just being in the same room together, coming face to face with a sort of a new humanity that like Mao was taken on. And there's a sort of a flash of recognition that Amelia has when Mao throws her a duvet, and she smells it, and she's like, "Oh shit, this is the detergent that
Yeah.
I use."
Yeah, they have something in common in this world.
Yeah, that's still one barrier falling away, I think. Yeah, and she, huddles up and cries a little bit.
Yeah.
And she's really lonely, but she doesn't realize how lonely she is. And
Yeah, she's really angry with herself, or like that's how she articulates it. She's angry with herself being the hero in her world, who's by the nature of her being, she should be enemies with Mao. And yet here she is needing his help. And she cries over that a little bit.
Mao picks up on it. He's like,
Yeah.
"Oh, she's really lonely." I'm like, "How the fuck are you the Dark Lord of shit? You're clearly like a nice dude."
Yeah, he has at no point since, I guess, getting their apartment, he has at no point seemed evil at all in the slightest.
Yeah, no, he's been a nice guy. Even the bits where they are buying and discounted eggs from the supermarket, only one carton per customer. Alciel suggests they like grab another carton and rejoin the queue, and he's like, "No, that's against the rules."
Yeah. Yeah, he's a good boy.
He's a good boy. He's a sweet boy.
A rule follower.
A mom friend.
As Ashia and Mao chat sleepily in bed, which I thought was very nice, Mao receives a text from Chio, ruminating over the possibility of more earthquakes effing up her shit. And that's the end of episode two.
A quick Seiyuu segment here before we march on into episode three. Yusha Emilia, the hero, aka Emi Yusa, is voiced by Yoko Hikasa. She's 35 years old, and she's been working in the industry since 2009. But she's got hella roles to her name. She's really been
Yeah.
hustling. And that's it as far as like trivia I could find about her. But in terms of roles that she's performed before, she has a role in Hamafura. Can you guess who she was? It's
Ooh.
not obvious. It's kind of tricky, but can you guess it?
I'm trying to think what she sounds like. I don't know. Who is it?
Yeah, no, that's okay. Well, she plays the voice of Baby Serious Deke.
Oh,
Like, Little Serious Deke.
no way. A little weirdo.
Yeah, he only, like, shows up, like, a handful of times, so it's not the most obvious, is it? But this is also the voice of Hana Sugarono in Seven Seeds.
Oh, no way.
Hell yeah, this is the,
I love Seven Seeds.
yeah, shout outs to Seven Seeds, underrated, not
Yeah.
talked about enough.
No.
This is the lady who befriends a bunch of adorable pig creatures, and then her friend shows up and cooks one of them, and she eats it accidentally, and she hates it. It's terrible. It's
God, the horror.
sad, but I. Kind of hilarious too.
Yeah, she, yeah, God.
This is also the voice of Farnese in Berserk, the adaptation that I will never watch. But that is a really awesome role to land. That's a really juicy role with some parallels to Yusha Emilia when I think about it, actually. Berserk, top tier manga, shit tier adaptation, unless we're talking about the 90s anime. This is also Pest Mask Senpai in Skullface Bookseller Honda-san, who I have an enormous crush on. This is Utako Sakura in Hinamatsuri. This is the busty bartender lady who rejects the main character and then disappears from the series halfway through.
Excellent.
I love it. This is the voice of Utahime Iori in Jujutsu Kaisen. Does that name ring a bell to you? I've only seen
Say the name again.
Utahime Iori.
No, but I've got to be honest. Even though I finished the show recently, I really struggled to follow the names of the characters. I think I could tell you the main character's name, but everyone else is kind of a blur to me.
Yeah. I've only seen 3 episodes so far. It seems all right. Strong episodes. This is the voice of Hwaryun in Tower of God. It's the red-haired lady who doesn't get much airtime in the first season, I guess. This is Laughter Franklin in Mobile Suit Gundam Iron-Blooded Orphans, the Princess Diana of Iron-Blooded Orphans. Lived her life like a candle in the winds. love you, Laughter. This is Popuko in Pop Team Epic, a series that I fucking adore, but they have a lot of voice actors voice the characters, and she's just one of many. This is Frida Reese in Attack on Titan, just sort of a...
Oh, yeah, they're like a minor character.
Minor character. And, she just gets chomped on by Eren's dad. That's about it.
Yeah.
And she's also the voice of the Sendawara twins in Shokugeki no Soma. These are the two ladies who run the Kuri Empire.
Okay,
Yeah. Cool. And apart from that, just many, many more roles. Lots of isekais from what I could tell. So we'll be seeing her again.
Awesome. She's accomplished. Episode 3. The Dark Lord goes on a date with his colleague in Shinjuku. We open with a bowl of pickles, left for Mao and Ashia as a sign of gratitude for allowing her the honour of sleeping on their floor by Amelia. Ashia's having none of it. He even criticises her technique for returning their keys.
do you think Ashia liked the pickles or not? Because he seems kind of...
I don't think he liked them.
Ambivalence. Because all he says is she is a formidable foe after all, or something like that.
Yeah, it seemed like he didn't like them for me. Mm. Or maybe he did like them. Oh, who knows? Back at her place, Amelia takes a shower and again berates herself for behaving so disgracefully as to accept help from the Dark Lord.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's just very nice of her to leave some pickles out, though. What I thought was funny, Mao asks Alciel what he would have done with the key if he was in her situation, and he says, "Well, yeah, I'll just take the key with me." And it's like, and he says, "You're such a devil or something," and Ashia says, "Akuma desu ka, nani ka?" Which, first of all, I love that delivery, but secondly, that is sort of the title of an isekai that was released like last year, called Kumo desu ka, nani ka? So I'm a spider, so what? I don't know. I just enjoy that phrase.
Yeah, very cute coming from Marcel as well. In the next scene, we actually see Chi-chan, Mao's colleague, at her home. and she's brushing her teeth and gleefully reminiscing about the texts that she sent to Mao the night before, the ones where she talked about the earthquakes coming.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them arrange to meet later in the day. She's super thrilled about this.
Yeah, she's brushing her teeth on the sofa. What the fuck is wrong with
weird,
you?
Yeah, weird, right?
I also wanted to point out Emilia, she was watching TV earlier and a news reporter is like, there's been a wave of muggings and robberies, etc. Yeah, so I'm here saying like, oh, someone else made it through the gate and they are not about that rat race life. These are the immigrants that the Daily Mail is warning you about.
Playing into their hands.
Yeah, it's not Emilia and Mao or model minorities, respectability politics, etc.
Yeah. At work, Emilia chats with her colleague, who once again invites her to lunch and gets cruelly rejected. Take a hint, girl.
I can't believe they try like so many times. Like,
yeah, every day she asks her for lunch or dinner or something, and every day Emilia says no. Emilia then takes a call from a disguised voice calling her out and threatening to take down both her and the Dark Lord and wipe them from existence. He thinks they are seriously pathetic and embarrassing. So this person calling, we have to assume, is somebody who else who's made it through the portal. They seem evil. Their voice sounds evil. They seem angry and they want to kill her and Mal.
Yeah, we got some theories.
Mm-hmm.
But I might get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, we'll get a bit more info about this in a bit.
Mm-hmm.
As the call ends, Emilia finally agrees to go for lunch with her colleague, but their plans are thwarted when she receives another call from the police asking her to come to the station and confirm Mao's identity. She is fuming, and her friend once again eats lunch alone, I assume.
They track down Mao and LCL by the bicycle that Mao owns.
Yeah, he left it right in place where they were getting shot at.
This is the third time that the police are like involved in the lives of these three, and like it seems like they're trying to say something, but I'm not sure quite what.
Yeah, he was at the police station. Damn it.
Yeah.
For some reason. Mao and Ashia just kind of sit there speculating about Emilia's age.
Yeah, LCL's doing the dating math, isn't he?
He is, yeah. He's trying to figure out how old she is. He calls her as lamb dressed as mutton.
Yeah, he does. I have no idea what that means.
Emilia chews them out. She even disparages the contents of their fridge. She yells at them for having so little in their fridge.
Yeah. Oh, they're all three of them just, they're petty, they have chemistry, they have history, and they know just what buttons to push, and it makes their interactions feel real and enjoyable. I like it.
Yeah, I love it. And Ashia is super devastated when she like makes fun of their home. He's like really put out for the rest of the scene.
Yeah.
He's really unhappy.
Yeah.
Outside the police station, Emilia warns Mao about the mysterious phone call that she received earlier, and he tells her to keep her voice down in public before she runs away. There are people staring at them because she is saying a bunch of crazy stuff about him being the Dark Lord, but he's just like, keep it down, woman.
Calm down, please.
Yeah. So we briefly, very briefly now, witnessed Chi-Chan picking out a dress for meeting Mao in.
Yeah.
Literally about 5-10 seconds of this for some reason.
Yeah, remember when people used to wear just shirts?
Yeah, she's basically wearing a shirt.
Just a shirt.
Yeah, a checkered shirt. I guess it's supposed to be a dress. And then Ashia turns into a personal stylist for Mao. I don't know where he got this skill, but he picks him out a stylish blazer. It's very nice. He's like dressing him. He tries to drive home the significance of Chi choosing Mao to confide in and insults Mao's regular clothes, describing them as Unislow outfit, which I guess is like a Uniqlo joke. I don't know. I don't quite understand this reference.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a Uniqlo reference, isn't it? And apparently that isn't up to snuff for LCL.
Yeah, I guess it's like Uniqlo clothes maybe or something embarrassing in this culture, I don't know.
Well, it's embarrassing to LCL in any case. As for myself, I get all my shit from Primark, so I'm not one to talk. But LCL is definitely aware that this is a date, and Mao's being a oblivious anime protagonist, and
Of course,
I'm just so thankful. And LCL's like, get your shit together. Mao is like, what are you, my mother? Yes,
Yeah, he
yes,
is.
yes, he is. He's like your mom and your biggest fan. And he's awesome. He's a great friend.
He's perfect, yeah. When Mao does meet Chi, she says his new look is very cool, and she's overjoyed when they agree that this is indeed a date.
Yeah.
So the Dark Lord Satan's officially on a date with a girl who's still in school, I guess.
Yep.
She goes to high school.
I mean, he is the devil after all.
That's true.
Yeah, as Chiyo's first levels at this point are off the charts. Like she's like,
Yeah.
can we hold hands? Mao agrees, and then he's like, well, I don't want you to get lost in the crowd. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You figured out, you've gotten to the point where you figured out this is a date, but you don't get hand holding. Like,
Oh,
Chiho does not have trouble navigating a crowd, bro.
Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. He comes from another world. Maybe that is the only reason people hold hands in his world, to avoid getting hit by cars. I was wondering if this is befitting of the Dark Lord. Like, what's he up to? I guess I'm kind of with. So I guess in the next scene we'll see Amelia is like very suspicious of this whole situation, and I am too. I'm like, well, what reason does he have for going on a date with this high schooler? He's just a nice guy. That's it.
Just
There's nothing satanic about him.
Well, like in the text that Chiyo sends him, she says, I think there's gonna be more earthquakes. Can I ask your advice about this? Or just like the weirdest way to ask someone out, but yeah, I think like Mao is genuinely out here trying to help Chi-Chan.
So the two of them head to a cafe in the subway station, I think. In the subway station, Ashia is watching Mao and Chi from a distance, around a corner, appearing extremely suspicious as he is caught out by Amelia, who happens to be passing by, I guess, on her way home from work. When she sees that Mao is on a date with Chi, Amelia assumes the worst. They must be trying to eat or kill her or something. Ashia explains that Mao is simply lending an ear to Chi, but Amelia seems to feel nothing but disgust for that idea. I'm with you, girl. There's something kind of gross about this.
I didn't think it was. I didn't sense any harm in it necessarily, but yeah, but I'm problematic, I guess. I'm canceled.
Cancel Lawrence.
Lawrence out here supporting the literal devil. Sorry, is this your king? This you, my man? Supporting Satan?
Literally supporting the Dark Lord of the Underworld. Amelia analyzes the scene of the date. She identifies that she is very much trying to seduce Mao and seems pretty impressed by the size of her boobs as well.
Yeah, and LCL's like,
What?
excuse me, what are you talking about?
Who?
LCL confirmed gay, thank you.
Yeah, he hasn't noticed them at all. Amelia decides to enter the coffee shop, I guess to spy closer, much to Ash's horror, but he goes with her. Meanwhile, in the coffee shop, she explains to Mal that her ears have been ringing a lot, and that the previous night she heard a weird voice in her room speaking in some strange language. Obviously, we the audience know that it seems like the same language that Mao speaks from his homeworld. However, despite it being in a different language, she understood every word. In his head, Mao considers the possibility that this is the idea link, a spell that allows humans to share ideas with each other across worlds. This technique could even be the cause of the earthquakes. Ashia and Amelia order drinks and watch over the date. Chi thanks Mal for his kindness and seems to be about to confess her feelings, but not on Amelia's watch. She interrupts the date and calls Mal an unfeeling dick.
Yeah, like Amelia just back in just full stalker X mode.
Yeah.
Just embodying the subsection of Twitter that will crucify you for inappropriate age gap relationships.
She's like saying, oh, you know, this man, he's going to hurt you. He's not who you think he is. All this kind of stuff that a crazy ex might say. Mm-hmm. Or any ex, if they were right.
Yeah, yeah. And they often are.
Mm. Chi actually draws the conclusion that this must be Mao's ex. She thinks that same. She gets that same vibe.
Mm.
Amelia is disgusted by the insinuation, but Chi persists with this approach and tells her to back off and mind her own business. Bechdel test passed.
We could put the feminism stamp on this one. The big red feminism stamp.
Yeah, the two female characters spend all their time arguing about the boy. All of a sudden, a big earthquake hits. The coffee shop caves in, and we fade to black.
It's a scary one, actually.
It is scary, yeah. Scary vibe all of a sudden. Chi wakes up with Amelia trapped in the ruins of the coffee shop. Mao and Asha are nowhere to be seen, but Amelia seems certain that they are still alive. She says in her head something like, I know that Mao's still alive because I'm going to be the one to defeat him.
Yeah. Or whatever. Yeah, she needs him to be alive.
She does. Amelia and Chi attempt to reconcile their differences, and they discuss Chi's feelings for Mao. She's super embarrassed, but admits she's crazy about the boy. Amelia assures Chi that she's not interested in Mao romantically, but also still warns her to stay away from him. She uses magic to put her to sleep, just to get out of this annoying ass conversation. Or is that why? Once Chi's asleep, she announces that it's okay for Mao to come out. She knows he's nearby. And so he shows up, but he seems to have regained his demon form.
He's in alpha mode. He's a Chad Mao.
He's got hoofs. He like comes out with these big hoofs. He's really tall and muscly. He has no idea why or how. And seeing this, Amelia resolves to summon her holy sword with the last of her magic and kill him. But she falters when Mao announces that he is going to rescue everyone that may be trapped under the rubble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the sight of a strong man taking charge.
Yeah.
It quells the momentary bloodlust in Amelia. Like,
yeah, she loves it. She's here for it.
Yeah. That's women for you.
Yeah, so Mao starts to, I guess, look through the rubble looking for survivors or whatever. And we end with Amelia questioning, why is the Dark Lord saving people? And I guess I ask the same question. What's happened to this guy?
Why indeed? Yeah. So he's received a sudden infusion of power from somewhere that allows him to partially regain his demon form. So that's not quite explained. So we've got like a exciting couple of episodes ahead of us. It's popping off. I'm excited to watch the next tree.
Me too. I want to see what happens. In that sense, this is like a kind of different vibe to Hammer Fur, in that like, while that was a good show and it was fun and funny, I never felt like, oh god, I can't wait to find out what happens next or whatever.
Yeah.
It was more just felt like along for the ride, but this is like actually quite intriguing, mysterious, and it's got some setup for stuff that's going to happen in the future.
Plots. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Got another Seiyuu segment for you.
Okay.
Elsiel, aka Shiro Ashiya, is voiced by Yuki Ono. He's 36 years old, and he's been working in anime since 2006. He got married in 2017 and had a kid last year, so congrats to you.
Yeah, congrats, omedeto.
Yuki Ono is also the voice of Louis in Beastars.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Cool. Right? That's,
wow.
Oh, wow.
I never would have guessed.
Yeah. It's an awesome role. Yeah. He's also the voice of Masayuki Hori in Gekkan Shoujo Nozaki-kun.
Wait, which one is that? Which character is that?
That's the president of the drama club.
Oh, I love that guy. I think he was my favorite.
The one who was constantly abusing, what was it, Kashima?
Yeah. Oh, God, I love that guy.
Constantly smacking around Kashima.
Yeah.
But they like each other secretly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good character.
Awesome.
So, and this is also Gran in Granblue Fantasy. I've been playing some Granblue Fantasy lately. So this is the voice of that character. He's also the voice of Josuke Higashikata in JoJo's Bizarre Adventure Part 4, Diamond is Unbreakable. I haven't gotten to that one yet, but
me either.
Pretty sure the JoJo fans appreciate that. And this is the voice of Isami Aldini in Shokugeki no Soma.
Oh, Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And also Taiga Kagami in Kuroko no Basket. And many, many more. Lots of isekais on his, in his, what do you call that?
Repertoire.
In his repertoire, including a isekai called Kyojin Zoku no Hanayome. I might have mentioned this once before in passing. This is the isekai where a guy gets transported to a world where guys can get pregnant by having sex with giants.
You haven't mentioned this before.
I might have mentioned it like very briefly.
Have you seen it?
I haven't, but I know it exists. And
I want to watch it.
Yeah, considering the remit of this podcast.
Hell yeah.
We will one day have to check it out.
I'm all for it.
Yeah, that's Yuki Ono.
So that's the first three episodes of Hataraku Mao-sama. What are your thoughts overall for the introduction to the show?
I extremely like this anime. This is a lot of fun so far. I liked it a lot the first time around, and once I watched the second time around with my brain switched on, so to speak, I liked it a lot more. Just a whole lot of fun to just chill out to. But once you watch it through a critical lens, there is a lot of different readings that you can draw from it, a lot of different approaches that you can take. There's a little bit of social commentary in there, sort of, but you can extrapolate some cool conclusions, some fun conclusions about observations about Japan from the point of view of an outsider, as an immigrant, as a gifted child in some senses. So I feel like the story is probably going to get a lot more supernatural from this point. But I really hope we get to see just more of Mao and Ashia just coping, basically.
Yeah, I really hope the same.
Yeah, those are the bits I liked. I liked seeing Emilia trying to keep her shit together, and she's fixed in this new life, and already it just seems like it's not going her way, and her anxiety and her loneliness are so evident, and once this this purpose to her life gets reintroduced, that's all she can think of, that's all she has in her sights, just not the healthiest way of adjusting. But I'm really excited about her arc, whether it's romantic or not. I'd like to see her grow and change into the hero that we know she is. Chiho, I thought, was kind of meh.
Yeah, I felt the same. I didn't really like her.
She's kind of a little bit fan service-y, cheesecake-y.
Yeah.
She's supposed to be the Osana Najimi, the childhood friend character archetype. Except with the booby slider on maximum, and the ending theme is sort of like this slow pan
I
of
know.
Chiho's body in like a bikini-esque outfit.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that. What the hell is that?
Yeah,
This girl's supposed to be in high school.
just like give him a little something horny for the otakus.
Yeah.
That's
It's a shame because when I'm watching shows like this, I always try and have thoughts about the female representation on it. I thought Emilio was great. She's a really cool character. She's really interesting, and she's like a multi-faceted character. She's got some depth, I think. She has motivation outside of the male characters, I think, although it's not super clear.
Not yet,
I
but
think you can extrapolate it. But then you have Chio just exists to talk about how great Mao is and like be sexualized. I don't think she serves much purpose other than that yet.
At this point, that's who Chiho is, but it's clear that she's going to have more involvement in the story, so there's
Yeah.
room to grow.
I think that's mainly clear to me via the opening sequence. You can see her hanging out with like a lot of different characters. So I assume we're going to meet some more people soon, and they're going to form a big old crew.
Exactly. Just briefly on Hataraku Mao-sama as like an isekai, just observations that I've made. I don't think anyone in the world can make a particular claim on a normalcy or like a normal life, no matter how normal it may appear from the outside. Your experience of your day-to-day is chaotic. There's no fixed kind of thing. So like I mean we create anchors for ourselves every day, and like we sort of reestablish ourselves every morning when we wake up. But this fantasy, this thing that we're supposed to escape to in Hataraku Mao-sama is the possibility of normalcy, this quotidian, something that you can hold on to from day to day, which is disrupted, of course, in these free episodes. There's also like the fantasy of competence, of being the central figure in the lives of the people around you, despite not meeting these soaring expectations that might have been placed on you before, being loved, being hated, being able to start from zero, start from scratch is another one of the fantasies that isekais like exploring. Like Mao is given a reset here, and how he chooses to use that is what the story that we're going to be presented with. And in a sense, we all have been a demon lord to someone in the past, and it's nice to know you could start over again with the help of the right friends, someone like Ashia in your life. So right now I'm really hyped to see more of this. I'm a little
Me
less
too.
excited about the supernatural, but I'm hoping to see more like mundane, like just struggling, coping. But it's only three episodes in, so it's still pretty early days.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can keep going with the sort of slice of lifestyle, and maybe the fantasy will be more of a sort of long-running threat or potential backdrop rather than like the main story. We'll see.
Closing thoughts for you?
Yeah, I also really enjoyed it. I like that it has a clear direction. It has a sort of like from the beginning, there's a goal that they want to work towards. But you imagine that maybe their goal will change, and you can already see it happening. I do think it's got some intrigue, some mystery. I'm curious to find out what the deal is with Mao and why being in this world has made him a different person. It's interesting because there are moments where you, when he's talking about his evil plan, which he does like a handful of times, where he gets this evil look on his face and he appears all sinister. And it seems like he does still want to do some evil plan of some kind, but he behaves like such a nice, decent young lad. I wonder if this is something that's going to be explained, if it's like baked into the narrative somehow that this change has happened to him, or if it's not going to be explained and we just have to accept it. And that's something I'm looking forward to finding out. Because Emilia, despite having come to a different world, I think fundamentally her ideology is the same as it was in her previous world, which is I have to defeat the Dark Lord Satan. That's what she's about, and that hasn't changed. Maybe, like you said, we just don't know enough about who the Dark Lord was in the previous world. Maybe he wasn't really evil, just wanted to make a home for his goblins to live on.
The precious skeletons.
And the precious Rasengan skeletons.
The precious Rasengan skeletons.
I think narrative and character-wise is pretty solid for me so far. That's our closing thoughts.
Oh, before we do the outro, I'd like to introduce a little segment here called Plugs.
Plugs.
Yeah, I want to do a little bit of shilling real quick because the podcast is alive right now, so listeners coming in. I just wanted to let y'all know that I run a YouTube channel at youtube.com/ Lobars, where I put together toy robots, aka Gundams. It's not much, but I have fun doing it, and if you want to see that for whatever reason, it's right there for you to enjoy. I'm like slowly building up a Gundam collection, and I have a lot of fun with it. And I'm also writing a newsletter, a Substack, which I'm having an enormous amount of fun doing. I've never written this much in a long time. It's just kind of shocking, actually, that I'm still capable of this. But yeah, I review the animes that I watch. I do a couple of reviews per week, and some thoughts on the general world of anime and enjoying this medium that we love. And I do a secondary series about Grand Blue Fantasy and the character designs in that game, and why I hate mobile gacha games. I have a lot of fun doing that. And that can be found at theeldarscrolls.substack.com. That's theeldarscrolls.substack.com. Hit subscribe, like and subscribe, etc., etc.
Excellent.
That's it for me. You got any plugs?
Not at the moment, but I'm sure I will do.
Hell yeah.
Well, next time on Reincarnated as Podcasters, we will discuss episodes 4-6 of Hataraku Maosama. We hope you enjoyed listening. See you in the next life.
Bye-bye.